So one of the things we, of course, need to talk about here is that we officially launched the podcast now. So the first four episodes that we've released have been, they were pre-recorded before the launch of Bookworm. And this is the first time we're recording since the launch of the podcast, which is kind of exciting.
Very exciting. It's gone pretty well, in my opinion. Gotten a lot of positive feedback, and it's cool to see other people chime in and say, hey, I never really thought of that before, but you made a good point in whatever episode. So,
right, right. I know Drew Kaufman was one that he wrote. We sparked something in him, and he wrote like an article about some of the stuff we were talking about, which is, it's interesting whenever you make a thing and you think it's going good and you think you're doing good at it, and you're not really sure because you're not to a point where your people are giving you feedback, and then you have something like that come up. So it's kind of exciting to see that. But to me, that's kind of like a validation of you're actually getting somewhere with something. So it's kind of fun to see some of the feedback on Bookworm. So if you're listening to this and you have feedback, we're all ears. We're interested. So to the point where, and I can talk, well, I'll mention this again at the end of the show, but I did go ahead and add a recommend a book function on our website. So bookworm.fm for the listeners. If you go out there, there's a button right in the sidebar. It says recommend a book. Fill that out and I will get that book added to our book list. And it goes into the queue for consideration on whether or not we'll read it or not. So,
and I'm excited about some of those ones that are coming in. I saw somebody recommended Brain Chains, and I actually, after the the next follow-up point here, Max Stock, where we actually talked to Brett Terpstra, he mentioned that he had David Allen on Systematic. So I went back and I listened to that episode again. And I think David Allen talked more about the research behind GTD in that podcast episode than he did in his updated Getting Things Done book.
Nice.
But one of the books that he referenced is that Brain Chains. So I definitely want to check that one out.
Yeah, I'm with you on that one, because that was one of the books I've read before we started doing the show, was The Organized Mind by Daniel Levitin. And that was one that I've heard David reference before as well. So yeah, when I saw Brain Chains come through, oh yeah, I want to read that one as well. So that one might make it into the list here pretty quick. I may have to bump some of my I may have to bump some of the ones I'm interested in up next in order to bring that one in. But yeah, that's definitely what I'm interested in. So as Mike mentioned, we both were over at Max Stock this past weekend as we're recording, and Mike got to present on stage, and I couldn't help but like do a little promo of Mike on stage talking about OmniFocus. You made me proud, Mike.
Thanks, Joe. I was hoping I would not disappoint you, seeing as how you wrote a book on OmniFocus.
No pressure, right?
Yeah, yeah. As I'm demoing stuff that I've picked up from Brett Terpstra, as he's sitting in the audience. Yeah, that was a little nerve-wracking, but it seemed to go pretty well. I got a lot of compliments on the presentation itself, so hopefully I convinced a few other people to try out OmniFocus.
Yeah, I know there were a few that had been previous OmniFocus users that listened to your talk, and then they're interested in getting back into it. So it's kind of interesting to see how people can jump from tool to tool. And, you know, we do that once in a while with the productivity spaces. You got to try out different tools once in a while just to make sure that you understand how to use them and how we like to work with them. So I don't know. It's interesting, but you did a good job. I was
thank you.
Very interested in your talk. So I thought you did a really good job. So well done, Mike.
Thank you.
And to kind of pivot into, I don't really have a good segue here, so I'm just going to jump in. So the book that we're going to go through today, we were talking about this a little bit ago, how to say this, but Essentialism by Greg McEwen. Right? McEwen?
I think so, according to the Google Talk YouTube video I found.
Okay, so Greg McEwen, Essentialism. This was my pick. And part of the reasoning, the rationale I had behind this, Mike, and I know that you voluntarily had this one on your list as well. So I'm interested in your reasoning for why you wanted to read it. But for me, I know there's just a lot of life that just feels really complex. We work in this whole technology space and we have a ton of tools and we have a lot of computers and stuff all over the place. And it's easy for that to get to be a lot. I just had a conversation with my wife about this probably 2 weeks ago, about how we have different pieces of our just everyday life take, you know, just music in the house. It doesn't sound like that big a deal, but the way ours is set up in the kitchen is I have a couple speakers up on top of the cabinets that are hooked up to like a Bluetooth receiver. So you can pair it with whatever, your iPad, iPhone, and then it plays that music through the speakers in the kitchen, which my wife loves. But at the same time, anytime your Bluetooth kind of falters, because it's not perfect, it'll disconnect. And sometimes you got to reconnect it, and it doesn't always work perfectly. But I get into my car and it doesn't have Bluetooth, and I plug it in and it works every single time. So I just feel like there's some of that is because we're techies and it's, we think it's cool and it's fun. Some of that I think is just pure, this is just too complex and it needs to be simplified. Does that make any sense, Mike?
Absolutely. And it makes sense to anybody, I'm sure, who's read Essentialism.
Yeah, true. True. And that's that was one of the main reasons that I wanted to pick this up, because I feel like I've got a lot of areas in life that I've overcomplicated without it being necessary, and yet I'm not real sure how to simplify it. At least I wasn't. Now that I've read the book, I have some ideas, which we'll get into. And one of the primary areas that I know I've struggled with this is nailing down projects to work on, because if you look through my email, and I right now, because of some of the clients and the other stuff I have going on, I'm getting about 300 new emails a day, which is just difficult. And no, that's not, there's no newsletters in that. That's filtered out. That's all the spam filtered out. That's usually one, or, you know, it's sometimes you get in group messages, but it's like one person emailing me directly. It's not any automated stuff there. I've pulled a lot of that out. So that's just direct emails. It's a lot. And there's a lot of those like project potential stuff in there. We should do something new. Like, there's just a lot of that, that it's easy to say yes, and the next thing you know, you're just completely bogged down.
Absolutely. And the interesting thing about that is I can definitely appreciate that perspective. I found when I read this, because this is the second time I've read this, the first time I got pretty different takeaways than what I got the second time. In between readings of Essentialism, I wrote a book called Thou Shalt Hustle. So that nice. Obviously is going to color my perspective here a little bit, and we can talk about the specific points here in a second. But it's been interesting because I've had to reconcile that stuff in my head. And yeah, it was just really, really interesting to read through it again. I caught a lot of things that I didn't catch the first time, and I interpreted things maybe a little bit different than I did the first time. So,
as far as like writing style goes for Greg, I thought this was really easy to read. Just my opinion there. But I thought it was really simple to get through. I feel like he didn't belabor topics, but he covered them really well. But at the same time, it's a pretty quick read, I think.
Yes, I agree. I will say that the first part of the book, I think I enjoyed a little bit better. Towards the end of the book, he gets into specific strategies. And I think I'm in a different place in terms of the articles that I've read, the books that I've read, the amount of information that I have acquired since I read this the first time, because a lot of those bullet lists regarding a specific topic could be a book in itself. Like, he has a book, or he has a five-page section or something like that on sleep. He's got another short section on play. There are entire books devoted to those topics. So when he gives you the quick bullet points, it's great if you just want like a quick win and you're just entering into that particular area. But if you have researched some of those, like I have sleep in particular, then it's kind of like, that's just like scratching the surface. Not necessarily a bad thing, but I just am saying, I think I got more out of the core ideas of the Essentialist lifestyle that he talks about at the beginning of the book, more so than the specific strategies towards the end.
Yeah. So that would be, so Greg breaks it off into four sections, with the first being essence. So if I go through those quick, so essence, explore, eliminate, and execute. The first of those, what you're talking about, the the way I summarized it was within his phrase that he uses to define essentialism, which is less but better. And is that the part you're talking about, that whole where you got the most out of it was the essence piece?
Yeah, he talks about the way of the essentialist, and he spends quite a bit of time defining that, which is really good. And that the key takeaway there, or the key idea there, I think, is to ask yourself constantly, am I investing in the right activities? He talks about creating the space to evaluate whether the things that you're doing are the right things rather than just going through the motions. But what's also interesting about this, and I kind of cheated because I was editing a podcast episode where we interviewed Greg on the productivity show literally today before we did this. And in the interview, he talks about how he didn't write a book called Noism. So essentialism is not just saying no to things, but he wrote a book called Essentialism. The key there is that you have to create the space to determine what is essential.
Yeah, that's interesting. And I'm really interested in this podcast that you're referencing on the productivity show by Asian Efficiency. So I'm definitely going to come back and edit the show notes after that releases, because that'll come out after this, correct?
I believe so. It might come out right before, but either way, I'll get you the link so that we can link to it in the show notes.
Perfect. Perfect. Yeah. No, the first part of this book, it was the one that impacted me the most. And the part of it that really, the first piece of it that really struck me, and this is something we all deal with, especially in the productivity space. We talk about this a lot with put your stuff first. I don't know why, but for some reason, going through this book, it made me really stop and think about that a little bit more, because, you know, I have clients, I have people I consult with, I have a lot of these other, you know, that's part of the reason I get so much email. I have a lot of that stuff coming in, so it's very difficult for me to say that, yes, this new website that I want to do for myself that could potentially get me to a point where I don't need to take on clients, which would be awesome if my clients are listening. I'm sorry. But if I'm going to make those websites real, if I'm going to make them into something big, then I really got to put them first. I have to get those things done before I step into the client work. Otherwise, it just doesn't happen. And you know, that's what I was talking about at the beginning. He talks about so much of this, the making decision process. And that was one of the notes I wrote down, Mike, was the book is really about a decision framework. From my standpoint, it was how to make good decisions about yes or no. And he had a quote that I thought was really interesting. He said, if it isn't a clear yes, then it's a clear no, which mm-hmm. is really, and we hear people say, you know, if it's not an absolute definite, you're super excited, this is going to be amazing, yes, then say no. And I think there's something to that that I've not considered in the past. So I'm glad I said yes to this podcast, because it's been a lot of fun. But there's just a lot of those projects that come up for me that I want to say yes, or I feel like I should say yes, but I really want to say no. So if it's not clear, I just need to let it go. But that's been a struggle of mine for a long time.
Yeah, so this is the interesting thing about reading this book now, because when I read it the first time, I was it was actually pre my transition to Asian Efficiency, working from home, basically getting the future that I've been dreaming about for a long time. And at that point, it made total sense. Yeah, I got to say no to this, 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 and this. But the way that my story has played out, it was because at one point I decided that this thing was essential, and I did say yes to both for a period. Now, you can't stay there. You'll burn out if you keep trying to do that for so long, but you can, I believe, say yes to things as long as they're important. See, that's the thing. He says you can't say yes to both, and I would agree with that in theory, because you can't physically be in two places at one time. It's kind of his point. But you can manage your time so that you can fit more of what is important into your schedule. So there are trade-offs, but it doesn't necessarily have to mean no to one thing just because it's you said yes to another thing, especially if it's in the same category. I think there's a lot of synergy between like this podcast and my work at Asian Efficiency, which is what allows me to pull this off, if that makes sense. But there will be sacrifices involved when you take that strategy, and you just have to take into account what the costs are. You have to make sure that those sacrifices are worth making, and you have to consciously choose what to do. I don't think that it is a straddled strategy, like he calls it, to make a choice that your basket will be filled with some of A and some of B instead of 100% of A or 100% of B. What you can't do is say, I'm all in on A, and then try to do B because you don't have any more capacity. Something has to give in that regard. But the big thing for me when I read it this time was not saying no to everything except the one thing, so to speak, but just saying no to the essential things and recognizing that there may be more than one essential thing, but you have to realize that it's a balancing act, and you have to make sure that everything that you've said yes to was a conscious decision to say yes to that thing, because it is an essential part of who you're supposed to be, what you're doing in the big picture.
I think about, because I get the question a lot about how to get started in an online business. I don't know if you get this question or not. Maybe you get it through Asian Efficiency, but I get a number of emails about how do you get started with a blog and online and how much do you make off of it? I get a lot of those. It really doesn't matter, because what they're really getting at is, can I quit my day job, do that full time, and then make enough money for my family off of that? Well, if you don't have a blog right now, the answer is no. Mm-hmm. I'll just answer that right now. You cannot do that. And the reason for that is that you really have to be doing both your day job and that, both of them basically full time, so that you can get the latter of the two up to a point where it's successful enough to foot your income or to support your family. And, you know, if you come from my standpoint, then even then the online business doesn't even get close to mm-hmm. supporting the family. It's just the way it works. That's why I do all the consulting. That's why I do all the web development. That's where the vast majority of my income comes from. And that's where, you know, if you follow Cortex at all, Gray talks about his spreadsheets. He's got all his spreadsheets that he uses to figure out if things are, if they're worth his time or not, which I would be really interested in some of those actual numbers, even though I know he will never make those available. But I do run a few of those scenarios as well, just to figure it out. And of course, it's what you would expect. If I have a client that comes up and they need a website, there's a 95% chance everything else will get dropped in order to do that, simply because that's where the vast majority of my income will come from, and it's the higher payoff in the long run. Well,
but that's okay if it's a conscious choice.
Right,
you
know, right.
He talks about how the way of the essentialist means living your life by design, not by default. So you can be in one thing, and by default, you would stay in that one thing. But if by design, you decide that this thing over here is the essential thing, you can't just all of a sudden just switch. You have to, like you said, you have to kind of hustle in the margins. You have to start that side business, start that blog, show up every day, and then you can make that transition.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you want to jump to the end, he starts to talk about routines and habits and making this whole process effortless. That's what you end up doing here, is you pick which ones are important to you. You know, if you use the whole the Eisenhower matrix, is that the name for it? I don't know why I always want to call it something
The Eisenhower else. Box. I teach that in almost every single webinar that I do for Asian Efficiency, because I love it so much.
Yeah, no, it just makes a lot of sense. And if you think about the important projects, we're so used to hearing that in the space we work in. And it feels like if you think about picking the important projects versus picking the essential projects, there's a likely difference there, but it's slight, because the important projects may be the ones that pay the bills, but in your mind, the essential ones could be the ones that drive you towards your core mission. My off base there. It just seems like there's a difference between the two that's important.
Yeah, I don't think you're off base, but I maybe would define it a little bit different. I think a lot of people would classify the things that pay the bills as urgent. You may have things that are important and urgent. So bringing home the bacon is both important and urgent,
right?
No, for most people. Sense. But we need to escape, as Sean Blanc would put it, we need to escape the tyranny of the urgent. So if you have that matrix, what you have is four boxes: things that are important and urgent, things that are important but not urgent, things that are urgent but not important, and then things that are neither important nor urgent. The urgent stuff is all on the left side of the box. And maybe I can put a picture of this in the show notes so people have a frame of reference. But that's where you get stuck. You know, going back to getting things done, that's emergency scan modality. That's looking for the next fire to put out. And when you do that, you don't, if you're not intentional, if you're not an essentialist, you neglect the things that are not important but are urgent. Those are the little things. He talks in here about the little things, doing them over and over and over again and producing that compound effect that produces the big results. That I've seen that work in my own life. I know that that principle does indeed work. And that's where a lot of people, I think, miss it, is you can do it once and you don't see anything from it. But if you do it again and again and again and again and again and again and again, then you start to get the results, but you don't see it at first, even though you're putting things into motion that are going to snowball and you're going to build up momentum like a steam engine. If you don't take that first step, if you don't step out there, if you don't create any motion, you'll never get to that point.
Yeah. I mean, how many times have we talked about the benefit of doing just a little bit each day, journaling, or, you know, take the blog example. You may not be able to write a blog post in a morning. You know, you probably, when you're first starting off, you probably aren't going to sit down and write a blog post in 20 to 30 minutes. Whereas right now, I've done it so much that I can write about 1,000-word blog post in about 25 minutes. Like, I just know that, and it doesn't take a whole lot of work. But that is a habit, and a, you know, to go clear back to the willpower instinct, that's something that's been built up. The self-control piece has been built up over time, and you get to a point where if you're writing just a little bit every morning, or you can write a blog post that quick and you can start to chip away at it and you build a full repository and it just grows over time, then before long you've got something big, and it's the little tiny add-ons that eventually get to a point where it's something massive. And he does get into that in this book a little bit. I don't think he spends a ton of time at it, but the one piece here that I wanted to bring up, Mike, was that he does talk about the trade-offs piece quite a bit, where if something comes up, and this is why I keep saying it's like a decision framework, because it's just a way of thinking and a way of processing decisions. And I think about our oldest daughter, who she always has a lot of toys out. It drives me bonkers that there's so many toys laid all over the floor. I'm sure you've got four boys. You know what I'm talking about. But the toys can get strung out all over the house. It drives me crazy. One of the things we did early on with her was give her a certain number of toys that were allowed to be out at one time. And if you're a parent, I highly recommend this. At least for us, it was amazing. But if you give her a certain number and say, if you want something different, that's fine, but you need to give me one of the toys that you have currently out in order to get a different one. And we don't allow this to happen but once a week. So once a week, she's allowed to basically trade in her toys for different ones if she wants. And then we've got boxes up in their closet where all the toys that aren't in action are hidden. And that works extremely well with her, because it teaches her to, you know, if I want something different, if I want to do something different, I have to say no to something else. It's that trade-off mentality of, if I want to say yes to a new project, I have to say no to a different one. Or complete one so that I'm not working on it at all. Something has to free up to allow me to say yes to that.
I think you should talk to Greg about writing a follow-up book, Raising an Essentialist Child.
There you go. I'll send him a note. We'll see what he says.
I really like that point, though, where if you're going to say yes to this one thing, you have to say no to another thing. But another thing that I added to it the second time I read this, you know, I mentioned that I kind of viewed it through a different lens this time, is he says, once you've sufficiently explored your options, you need to ask yourself what you should say no to. And then my question is, how do you know if you, like he says, is this exactly what I'm looking for? how do you know if it's what you're looking for if you never try it? Because I never pictured myself as a writer, yet I started writing, and that has led to every opportunity that I am pursuing right now.
Right.
So I would not have gotten that without stepping out there and trying something different. And I think it's really easy. If you read this, you say, yeah, I'm overcommitted. I'm doing too much. I got to say no to a bunch of things, to just say, this is my box. And I've got to say no to everything else that doesn't fit in this box. But I think a lot of people maybe haven't explored, and they haven't found that thing that they really were made to do. I forget who said it, but somebody said there's two important days in your life, the day you were born and the day you find out why. And I thought I knew why, but in the last couple of years, that's been redefined for me. And honestly, I think it's going to be redefined a couple times. I think this is going to be an evolution or a journey. And my story is not completely written yet. So yeah, you have to ask yourself, what are the things that aren't contributing to where I'm supposed to go? But I also think it's important to just step out there and try some stuff, even if you don't think it might be essential. You know, say no to some things, but don't be afraid to try something, even if it sounds completely off the wall.
I'm going to jump ahead on you here, because one of those action items that you wrote down is find more time to play. And I almost wrote that one down too, because that's, you know, that's the explore piece, that second part of the book. And the main thing that he has there is making time to escape, basically giving yourself a buffer zone to focus, and then using that time to play and explore and find some of those things. I think that's what you're talking about, is how do I give myself the freedom to go explore things and find something different? Because I think about, you know, I'm a web developer, and when we were at MaxDoc, somebody asked me this question of how many computer languages I know. So I had to tally it up, and it was 26. So I have worked in, within the last 2 to 3 years, I've worked in about 26 different computer languages in some form or another, which is crazy if you stop and think about it. But the only reason that I've picked those up, and the only reason that I know those, and for the web developers out there, there's a good chance that if you pick one of those and you ask me to build a full-on, really sophisticated application in that, I would fail horribly, just to throw that out there. Like, that doesn't mean I'm 100% proficient in all of them. It simply means I've built something in them. But the only reason I've picked those up, and the only way I've picked them up, is through kind of a small project to begin with, and then just being given the freedom to play with it and just to see if it'll work. And I personally make sure that I give myself time to do that quite a bit. You've seen some of the scripts and stuff that I write. I make sure that I've got time every week to just work on systems and work on the productivity tools and the apps and, you know, all the Apple scripts and such. I specifically set time aside each week to work on that stuff, just because I know that if I give myself that freedom, you know, you were talking about the opportunities that come whenever you, when you started writing, and how that's opened up a lot of doors. For me, a lot of that has come through writing scripts and just giving some of the small program type stuff away. And that stuff was built by playing around with things just to see how they work and see what I can figure out with them.
Yeah. So here's a really important distinction, though, because you could look at that a couple different ways. You could look at writing those scripts as work instead of play. But I would argue, like you're saying, that that is actually play. And if you viewed it as work... Yeah, exactly. See, you have to kind of define for yourself what play looks like. It's not always busting out the Legos or fill in the blank. You know,
right.
There are things that bring me joy that other people would classify as work. And I absolutely love to do them. Like, this podcast would probably be one of those things where every time that we get on the mic, I end up getting a different perspective and I learn a lot. That to me is play. But you could also look at your situation in particular. You know 28 different languages. Well, he talks in the book about being a mile wide and an inch deep, or an inch wide and a mile deep. So some of those languages you don't know as well as others. Some of those languages,
oh, absolutely.
If you were to try to maintain that through the lens of work, you're like, well, you know, this is a lot of maintenance effort in order to even be able to do basic projects with this. But when you're playing, there's no requirements on it. There's no definition of done, so to speak. You can just enjoy the experience. And I think that is the key difference. And then you need to be able to not feel bad about liking to do these things that wouldn't normally be classified by other people through the lens of play. Like a lot of the people, especially where I live in Neenah, Wisconsin, I tell them I work on a remote team. They look at me like I've got a third eye. They're like, you don't actually work.
Right. You know? Sure you do, Mike. So, you don't have a job, do you?
Right. So I'm already the oddball, and I've just learned to embrace it. My kids actually, if you tell them you're a nerd, they go, thank you.
That's awesome.
But yeah, like you don't have to do it the way everybody else does it. It's okay to play with some of those things, and then eventually, like you said, you'll kind of discover, yeah, this is something right here. This is going to become my one thing. That is a very pivotal point when you discover something and then you decide that yes, this is the thing I want to go a mile deep on. You can't really do that, I would argue, if you don't have the play element, like you said.
Absolutely. I know that with, you know, we're going through this whole languages thing. For me, if you want to go down that, now, every web developer, if you don't know HTML, CSS, and JavaScript, you should not be a web developer. Like, those are just, you have to know those. And for me, whenever it gets into the server side of things, and we're getting all technical here, but I know that even though there are the 26 languages, I know that if I stay within PHP and Ruby and Rails, if I stay in those two, those are my wheelhouse. And I know that if projects come up and they're based on those, easy. Like those are simple systems to take on. But if someone comes up with Python or they want to do something on Django, which I know I'm way over some people's heads here, whenever those projects come up, it's one that I know and I've built stuff on that, but it's not one I see every day. So it's not one that I'm super deep on and it's not a priority. So honestly, whenever those come up, my rate goes up simply because I know that it's going to take me longer and it's going to be more complicated for me just because it's not something that I work in every single day. And there have been some cases where those come up and I just say no to them just because they want something done really quick and really easy. They don't want to spend a lot of money on it. I don't know it well enough to do it in that amount of time. So it's not worth moving forward. So welcome to essentialism. No, I'm not going to do that.
Right. Now, here's an important distinction, though, I think, because your one thing might be to be a Ruby developer, but you may not discover that that one thing is to be a Ruby developer unless you try out some of those other languages. And sorry for the code examples, but you can kind of fill in the blanks here. He has a phrase in there. He says, five different jobs in five different industries do not add up to a forward-moving career. I think the key phrase there is the five different industries, because what I've found is that one thing can lead to another thing, can lead to another thing, can lead to another thing. And yeah, you're making small adjustments in your direction or your course as you go. You're kind of course correcting, but you're not deciding to all of a sudden move in a completely opposite and different direction. I think there is some synergy there when you take that approach. So you can try out a few different things if they're somewhat related like that. They're under the same general topic heading. And then you have a much better chance, I would argue, by taking that approach than just saying, I'm going to try this, I'm going to try that, I'm going to try that. Just randomly picking occupations off a list and trying to go all in with those things. I think that is the approach that leads to what Greg would say, you're being a mile wide and an inch deep.
He has a chapter in here that I really loved and I really hated. Chapter 5 called Escape. The tagline of this is the perks of being unavailable. Contrast that to my 300 emails a day. And I have some work to do, Mike. It's just not good. I read that and it makes a lot of sense of separating to give yourself time to reflect, focus, think through what all of your decisions need to be. Because I don't remember where I read this. If somebody's listening to this and you know where this stat is, I would love to know where this is. But at one point I read the stat that said if you receive 100 emails in a day directed to you, then email is your full-time job, as in that's where you spend all of your time is in reading and responding to emails, which, you know, I've worked with some corporate executives. That's their job. Email is their job, is to read what other people have going on, make decisions, and then kick off new decisions about some of the things that are going on. So I get that, but if I get 300 a day, that means I've got 3 full-time jobs just in email. And again, I'm not real sure where I got that number. I wish I could remember where I found it, but that tells me that, one, it's too easy to get a hold of me, and I already have people upset because I'm hard to get a hold of. So Mike has my cell phone number. That made me a little nervous at first. I'm not going to lie, Mike. I love you, but man, that giving that number out is not something I do very regularly. And it's one that I know, and I've never had anybody take advantage of it. Part of that's because there are very few people that actually have that number. But when it comes to email, I have not restricted that at all. I've been pretty good with my phone number, but the email address, I've always just broadcast it out there. And this actually made me stop and reconsider. Maybe I should pull that off of some things, just because I'm getting too much right now. Because a lot of that's new stuff, new people that are emailing me off of the website. So I don't know. It just made me rethink it a little bit.
I would argue that if you're getting 300 emails a day, you should do whatever you can to remove your email.
I know.
As many places as you can.
I know. And at this point, I'll need to change my email address too. It's like, okay. So I liked that part, but at the same time, it was very humbling and very challenging to think about becoming hard to reach and just being someone that's not easy to get a hold of, because in some respects, I know that I'm already hard to get a hold of. So if you've sent me an email and I haven't gotten back to you, now you know why, because I've got 300 every day and I don't check email on the weekends. So that means Monday morning, there's about 500 to 600 to go through on Monday morning. So that's just the way it is.
Yeah. And he actually talked a little bit about your specific scenario there in the book. He said, I'm not sure if you remember this, boundaries are very important. If you make an exception, you'll end up making it many times.
Yes, I know. And it's funny because there's a, and I can't think of the author right now. There's a book called Boundaries. Are you familiar with this?
I'm not.
I want to say Henry Cloud. Don't quote me on that. I'll have to look it up. I'll put it in the show notes. But I read it at one point, and it's about how do you set boundaries with other people in your life. And he goes through like friends and family. That's kind of his focus. And the main crux of that book is, you can't change what other people do. You can only change how you react to it. Now, let's go back to the obstacle is the way. You just take things that come at you, make a decision on how you can respond to it, and get to work. Whereas we would normally just react emotionally and get all upset over it. And, you know, that was the premise of it, was let's not let things get to us and not break those boundaries, but setting those walls in place. So I should probably set some walls around email. But there's so many good opportunities that come through email, Mike.
It's true. I would say you definitely need some boundaries there.
Yeah, the whole fear of missing out thing.
Yeah, I mean, that's really what it comes down to, is the fear of missing out, which I thought it was great to hear that term in this book too, because that's something that I preach all the time, is like, you have to overcome FOMO. But really, I would say the tipping point, whether you get 3 emails a day or 300, is, are you able to keep, as Stephen Covey would say, the main thing the main thing? So that's a question that every single person has to answer for themselves. I can give you my opinion, because I know what I would feel like if I got 300 emails a day. But maybe you have a system in place where you can handle that efficiently. You know, I haven't seen you handle email, so I can't answer that. And I think that it's important to recognize that. A lot of times we will just go along with the flow, and we will do things that we've already committed to. And that was another one of my takeaways, was to evaluate everything that I've been committed to without, Greg talks a lot in the book about the sunk cost bias, about how we overvalue things that we already own. And in particular, we overvalue our commitments to things that we've already agreed to. So one of my takeaways is, I want to list out all the things that I've agreed to, all the things that I've said yes, and ask myself at this point, if I wasn't already doing this, would I start? Because I think when I do that, I'm going to be surprised at how many no's I see. And I think that's probably a pretty common response. I challenge anybody else who's listening to this to do the same thing. And we'll kind of go through the process together. But we need to identify the things that are essential, like he's talking about. You have to say no has to be the default. It can't right. be it can't be an exception. No has to be the default. And then you frame your whole life around the things that you've consciously said yes to, as opposed to the things that just kind of get added onto your plate and you didn't say yes or no, but you end up having to prioritize those because somebody else has determined that. You know, he said that if you don't prioritize your life, somebody else will. And I've seen that. I've seen that in my own life. You have to decide what's most important for yourself. And then you have to put up those boundaries, like we were just talking about, to keep out all the other things, all the other commitments that people try to throw on you. Because every one of those things that you commit to is going to chip away at the amount of time, the amount of energy, the amount of focus, the amount of margin that you have in order to actually do the things that are important well.
So you're talking about this whole reevaluate your current obligations without that sunk cost bias, Mike. And, you know, we've talked about MacStock this past weekend. And at MacStock, Mike and I actually got to meet each other finally in person, which was awesome. And Mike was gracious enough to bring his wife along. And so I got to meet her and we had a great time as well. So whenever you do this reevaluation of current obligations, Mike, I want you to build on it and get her involved.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think she wants you to say no more. So,
yeah, probably. Fair enough.
So one of the things that I know, because I'm kind of the same, Mike, I've got too much going on. And part of the reason I say you should do it with your wife is that's what I did. Because I got done with this and immediately knew I've got a lot going on. I know that my wife is... one of her talents is discernment. She's very good about taking a lot of options that are in front of you and then making a decision, a really wise decision about it, which is frustrating at the same time, but she's very good at it. So I always enjoy getting her perspective on some things. So I just took a lot of the big projects I've got going on and put it in front of her and just like, let's just talk through this and work through it with her. Now, thankfully, she understands my business well enough in order to actually have those conversations. But I did cut a few projects. That means firing a few clients and moving on. But overall, I mean, it does free you up quite a bit. And at the same time, that gives you a lot of freedom to go do the play thing.
Yeah, that's a really important point that you bring up is the power of agreement. And at the very end of the book, he talks about essentialism in the context of a team. But I would argue that there is no more important team than you and your significant other. And when you are in agreement about the things that are really important, that's when you can really, as a team, create some momentum and take some action on those particular projects and accomplish those goals. There's a principle called the two-horse rule, and the math behind this can kind of be debated, but the principle definitely applies. If you have one horse that can pull 300 pounds, a second horse that can pull 150 pounds. Together, they can pull not 450 pounds, but something like 800 or 900 pounds. And there is a force multiplier when you get those things moving in the same direction. And there have been times where my wife and I were pulling in opposite directions, and we didn't even realize it. Everything just got super hard. And then eventually, you know, enough, when pain is sufficient, change will come. We sat down and we're like, why is this so difficult? And we identified, well, she had been prioritizing this thing. I had been prioritizing that thing. And when we got on the same page and we said, as a family, this is the thing that is important, and pursued that together, that made everything so much smoother.
Yeah. The last bit of the book here, he goes into the execute piece. So you got essence, the exploration, eliminate, and then execute. For me, I went through this and the very first thing I wanted to do is, what does my day look like? Because he's all about how do you make execution effortless? How do you get it to where the stuff you're trying to work on just happens automatically? And I think that's awesome, but that's you know, you and I write about this all the time. Well, habits and how do you trick yourself into getting a lot of stuff done? You go back to Kelly McGonigal's book and how do you build the willpower to get a lot of things done in the day and beat your bad habits. It's all the tips and tricks stuff to convince yourself to get the right essential stuff done. Did that make you want to go through your whole daily routine? Like, I just want to change everything now, which is a really bad idea, but it just made me want to rethink everything.
Yeah, that was one of my takeaways, was to reevaluate my daily routines and to decide what is actually essential there. But when I read that section and I heard him talk about execution, every time I heard the word execute, really what I thought of was systems. So yeah, that's the efficiency mechanism, in my opinion, that makes that all work. And if you build up the right systems, if you develop the right habits, the right rituals, the right routines, that allows you to increase your capacity, I would say, not so you can just fill it up with more stuff. Like I said, you know, the default has to become no. But I would argue that when you have these systems in place, your ability, the amount of resources that you have at your disposal to throw at the things that are most essential, goes up. And when that happens, you might find something like this podcast, for example, which helps me synthesize these books that I'm reading, which is part of my job at Agent Efficiency, because the value that I bring to the organization is when I learn this stuff, I apply it in my own life, and then I teach it to other people. So this is, I would argue that this is kind of like a system that allows me to get more done in that other, like there's crossover there, there's synergy there, there's the efforts that I expend in prepping for this podcast, and I've been upfront with a lot of people and said, you do most of the work, all the editing and all that stuff. But that's the reason why I agreed to do this, is because that this has benefits across the board, because all of those efforts, while they are different, there are like clear lines or delineations between them, they are all moving in the same general direction.
Yeah, absolutely. And I know that, because I love this podcast, because, you know, we think about, you create a podcast, you kick it out, you try to get people excited about it, you hope people listen to it. You just kind of wonder if there's a lot of people listening. And I know there are, but when it really comes down to it, the core benefit that I find, Mike, through this whole podcast is that you get to read a lot of interesting books, which in and of itself can be extremely beneficial. There's a lot of benefits and positives that come out of reading books, especially when you read this many. I mean, if you're reading one every 2 weeks, you go through a lot of books very quickly. And if you're doing that, you're really filling your mind with a lot of awesome information. And when you sit down to do this podcast and we record it and we're talking through it and this is what I got out of it and this is what I'm thinking about it, it gives you that secondary perspective on what the text says, which then gives you the ability to do even more with it. So yeah, I mean, we do a lot with what we learn through, because I know it's impacted like the blog posts that I write. So I'm sure it's affected your writing in some form. But I know that as we process and as we think through these things, yes, there are a lot of business benefits that come out of it, but there's a lot of things that are used and put into effect simply from a daily life standpoint. I mean, look at what Greg's talking about. Put your daily routine together so that you can get stuff done. I mean, you go through all these books that we've already been through, and there's a lot about how do you set aside all of the resistance? How do you set aside the difficulties within your own mind or in your environment so that you can focus on the most important thing and get it done? I mean, what else is there to do in life? I mean, you're all about setting your mission and let's go after it. And this is the tips and tricks you need to get it done.
Yeah. And I think that getting it done for the sake of getting it done kind of misses the point. I think that when it comes to like my own personal mission is to be better every day, and I will never complete that project. It is a qualitative project, not a quantitative project, if you want to define it as a project.
If you figure out how to complete that one, you let me know.
All right, I will. But when I was thinking about that in particular, as it applies to, like, why do I even read these books in the first place? It is because I want to benefit from these books. It's not just to mark things off on a list. I want this stuff to impact my life, how I deal with the things that I have to do, how I interact with the people that mean the most to me. I want that to consistently be moving in the right direction. I don't want that to atrophy. I want it consistently be getting better. And I think that there's a very important mindset difference here. If you're looking at checking things off of a list, I want to be able to do this, this, and this, then the natural solution to any resistance that you could encounter would be to throw more resources at the problem. Okay, but he says in here, where did it go? He talked about how instead of throwing resources at the problem, what we should be doing is we should be looking at how do I remove the obstacle? And that's what I think this podcast has done for me is the goal is how do I synthesize this material? How do I get the most out of it? Well, if I was just doing this, looking at this through the lens of checking things off of a list and adding more resources, what I would do is I would try to increase the amount of time that I spend reading books. I would read more books. I would listen to more podcasts, more audiobooks. But in order to be effective, I knew there needed to be some synthesis that needed to take place. And the whole idea of a mastermind has been something that I've been really interested in a long time. So that's kind of what I view this as, is like we can get together, we can talk about these things, we can throw things back and forth. I can have you say, no, Mike, that's a terrible idea. I've done it this way and it doesn't work. But that is the thing that makes a qualitative difference. And I just hope that that encourages people who are listening to this. Like when you are looking at something, don't necessarily look at how do I overcome this, but how do I remove that obstacle? How do I make the journey easy? I don't want to say easier. It's not really easier. It's just, how do I decrease the amount of resistance that I will encounter on this journey as I pursue the essential things?
And it's more rewarding. I think that's what you're getting at, is that let the journey be rewarding and don't just focus on the outcome. Is that what you're trying to say? Awesome.
Yeah.
There we go.
Case study.
There you go.
Right there.
I think we've gone through, looking at our notes, I think we've gone through all the action items. Oh, save one. So on my end, one of the things that I've done, and this sounds bad, and I'm just going to preface this with, I'm sorry, but there's a number, because I did kind of an inventory of the people who I interact with and the folks that I associate with just in day-to-day life, and trying to evaluate whether or not people are, it sounds terrible, Mike, to just talk about it this way, but
just say it.
I'm just trying to,
like, abandon right off.
There you go. But it's one of the things where the people you associate yourself with are, you know, the average of the people you associate with, that's who you become. And the more I thought about the essentialism mindset of focusing and going deep on certain friendships instead of trying to spread them all out and just try to maintain a ton, I really tried to narrow that down to a smaller group, which means that there are some of my friends that I'm going to be limiting my time with to focus on some of these deeper relationships. So I think there is some of that this can easily spread into a lot of arenas. He talks about that a lot. This is a mindset. This is a way of making decisions. That's why I keep saying that. And it's a way of thinking and a way of asking questions to bring you to, what's he call it? The highest level of contribution, I think is what he calls it.
Mm-hmm.
It's the less but more mindset. But I think there's a lot of value in that in the long run.
I 100% agree. I kind of thought of it this way. Like if you were to spend an hour with 10 different people throughout a week, you're going to get a little bit of benefit from those relationships. But if you were to identify like two people who really you click with and they help you they help you do more and be better, so to speak. Like they are the people that challenge you. They're the people that call you out. They're the people that help you to be better and live more truthfully, to live more true to your calling. I would argue that if you were to spend 5 hours a week with those two people, it's the same amount of time on the surface, but the amount of impact that that is going to have is going to be significantly more just because you've kind of focused everything in the same general direction. So he talks in there about like the paradox of success, where the clarity of purpose leads to success, leads to new options and opportunities, and you end up doing too much and being spread too thin. But I think kind of what you're talking about, spending the time with the right people, is kind of an example or to the exception, which is like success stacking, where you're doing maybe multiple things and you're repurposing those essential few. That leads to exponential increase in results. And it sounds kind of mean to frame that when we're talking about people, but it is, in my opinion, 100% true. You have to be careful who you're going to allow speak into your life. I think the quote that you were looking for before was, you are the average of the five people you spend the most time with, which I've heard John Lee Dumas say. I don't know who originally said it, but yeah, I've had to do that too. I've had to reevaluate, who am I going to let speak into my life? And more, it's not who it has traditionally been. And that's why the reevaluation, a consistent reevaluation, is so important. That, I think, is my big takeaway, is that you can never 100% say, okay, I've got this completely figured out, that this is a process. And that's why I say I'd be happy to reread this book again, because I think what is essential to me now will be different than what is essential in a year. Maybe it's a little bit more focused. Maybe it's something completely different.
Well, yeah, I mean, you're going to have a lot of experiences between now and then, and it changes the way you look at things. And whenever you come back and read it again, it's just a different perspective on it. And that's just the way it works. So Mike, you and I could talk about this thing for a long time, I think, but I'm looking at the clock. We're going to need to wrap this up. But again, I think we could talk about this for a long time. It's just a great book, and it's one that I know I've already recommended it to a couple people who are struggling to make decisions on what specific projects and what specific things should they be working on. So I've already recommended it to a couple people. So for the listeners, again, we recommend this one. At least I would. And with that, I feel like this one, from a rating standpoint, I'm going to jump into that piece here. But I would put this at a 5, because I know that this has had a huge impact on me as far as how I make decisions. There's a lot of the previous books that we've read, Mike, that can impact the way you think and can give you a different perspective on things. But for me, this one had significantly more actionable content in it that I could immediately put into effect. And I think that was something that really had a big impact on me.
I agree. And if I would have read it, if I'd have rated it after I read it the first time, I would have given it 5 stars as well. But I'm going to say 4.5. And this is the only reason why. It's not because there is anything in the book that I disagreed with, but it was because as I read it this second time, I found that I actually had a lot more questions. And if I could take Greg out for coffee and talk to him for an hour, I'm sure he would be able to resolve some of these discrepancies that are in my head right now. But I just didn't quite get to the point where in my mind, all the I's were dotted, all the T's were crossed. Still a phenomenal book.
Does he answer any of those questions on the Asian Efficiency podcast?
Kind of. Like one of the things that he said there was he has an acronym WIN, which stands for What's Important Now. I think if you were to boil down essentialism, just ask that question, that would maybe not fall into the specific mold that he's outlined so strongly in the book, but I get it. I know who he's writing this book to, because I was that guy the first time that I read it. But now having read it the second time, I still think that there's some additional ground to take here. And then another thing that he said, I know he talked a little bit about it in the book, but he really kind of expounded on it, was make the slowest thing go faster. I think he put it another way as like find the Herbie. He's talking about the Boy Scout troop.
Yep.
So if you haven't read the book, the basic idea is that if you have a system, you have a bunch of people who are all moving in the same direction. If you make the slowest person go faster and spread out the weight amongst the other people who are already moving a little bit faster, then the whole group will accelerate. And that is systems, in my opinion. And that just kind of illustrates the point. And this is why I say if I actually could get coffee with Greg, I'm sure he would clarify this, but he doesn't explicitly say it in the book. Kind of my experience, though, is that it's okay to do more. If the trip takes 2 hours instead of four because you've created the systems to do these things more efficiently, then you have more in the tank. You can add more essential items, would be my argument. Now, obviously, I'm putting words in the mouth of Greg, but I kind of think that he would agree with that.
I think you're getting at the mindset of putting a lot of extra work up front so that you can do more later. Is that
exactly
fair? Because yep. I know I do that all the time. That's where do you think a lot of my scripts come from? Like, I even wrote a script. I should link to this, Mike. I have a script for reading books. It's awesome. So if you're an OmniFocus user, I have a script for you. I'll link to it in the show notes. You'll like it. So what's coming up, Mike? What's on the list of what are the next books coming down the pipeline?
Well, the next book, and maybe we should have switched these around a little bit. I think this one's probably going to be very similar, is The More of Less by Joshua Becker, which is a book that I have heard a lot about. Joshua Becker has been on the Productivity Show podcast. I think he spoke at the Think Better, Live Better event. I've just heard a lot of great things about his work, and I'm excited to dive into that one.
Yeah, and then following that, so that one's Mike's pick. The one following that I've picked up, Deep Work. And this one kind of plays into the focus bit, I think. There's a lot of people that have read it, and it's got a decent amount of hype around it right now. And there's a lot of that I'm just curious about. So I'm interested in Cal Newport and how he comes at thing. I've recently subscribed to his blog, and he has a lot of really good stuff there. So I'm interested in seeing what his latest book is all about. So, Mike, I did a little bit of work on some stuff on the website. I don't think I told you about some of this. I'm sorry. But
you're telling me now?
Maybe this is confession. I don't know. But as a developer, and since I kind of control the bookworm.fm website, I made a list of books on the site. So if you go to bookworm.fm/list, there is a list of all the books that we've read, followed by a list of the books that we're planning to read, followed by a list of the books that have been recommended. So there's a way for you to see all three of those, and it's without any of the show notes or anything. It's just the pure list with links on the ones that we've already done. So if that makes sense, if you can follow me on that. But anyway, it's a list of the books that are important to Bookworm. And as a part of that, we are really interested in your recommendations. So as we were talking about with the Brain Chains piece, you know, I think that one probably is going to come up here pretty quick. So if you have a recommendation, you've got your favorite book and you don't see it on that list, go ahead and hit that button, fill out the form. It'll hit my email, which don't expect a fast response, but it will get there. And then
if you want to add to Joe's complex, go ahead and recommend a book.
I think I need to move to forms and just don't give out the actual address. Maybe that'll help. I don't know. I'll let you handle it. Maybe that'll help me. You may not like that. Anyway, so you can recommend a book out there. The last thing, and then you've got one I think you want to talk about, but I actually made a list of authors on Twitter, so the whole Twitter list thing. There are a number of the authors that we have read that are on Twitter, so I just made a public list there. So if you want to follow, subscribe to that list, you can do that and see what all these authors are currently working on. So I don't know if that's of any interest, but it was pretty easy and I thought it would be kind of fun. So there you go. And then you want to talk about remarks?
Sure. So we are going to try something new for our podcast book club. There's an app called Remarks. The website is remarks.fm. And the idea is that it is a social podcast player. And you can comment on any of the episodes, and it'll have the time code there. So if you want to join in the discussion, you can leave a comment on Remarks. And then I believe as the host that we can either log in or we get notified whenever people leave comments so we can respond. Hopefully it'll be a way that we can interact with our listeners, but it's kind of an experiment. So we're not, I think it's safe to say we're not really committing to this 100%, but if you want to check it out, it might be a cool way to work together as we read through these books.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. It's a it's an interesting platform to basically leave comments on something midstream. So if you're listening to a podcast and we say something that you think is completely off base, you can argue with us on there. So it's a way to do it. Yeah, you could call us out right at that exact timestamp. So I think it's interesting. And I think they've got us as verified hosts of Bookworm on their platform. So I think that it'll be interesting. I'm curious to see how that plays out. So if you're into that kind of thing, go check out remarks.fm. There's an app on the App Store for it as well. I can link to all this stuff in the show notes, all this, the book list, recommend a book, list of authors, remarks. I'll link to all that in the show notes. So should be interesting. I think there's a lot going on. I know there's a lot of people starting to interact, especially with us on the Twitter feed. So kind of cool. It's fun to see how people are interacting with it.
Definitely. And one thing that we would really appreciate is if you would go to iTunes and leave us a review. If you do like the podcast,
oh, yeah, absolutely.
Love a 5-star review. But even if you hate the podcast, let us know what we can do better. We like constructive criticism.
Yeah. Like Mike said, go check out iTunes, and we will see you all next time.